If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch and it's open to creatives from all around the world, whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. If you've got the stitch bug, this is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry to get your ticket today. Orly Kogan is a New York-based needlework artist whose otherworldly creations on vintage fabric are modern fictions, icons of femininity, masculinity, with a modern variation and yet a classical style. This is the second part of my conversation with Orly, and we have a great talk around the houses. We find out about her creative process, how she is experimenting with different media, how her work has changed since she became a mother, the way the path has evolved over time. And of course, we find out about Orly's favourite musical types, the kind of books she reads, the last good film she watched, and a really interesting fact about Orly that prompts a conversation about the value of family and a nostalgia for things that haven't happened yet. I hope you enjoyed this show. As I said, Orly's a fantastic artist. I'm such a big fan, and it was lovely having this conversation with her. So I hope you enjoy it. I'll be back next week with an interview with a different artist. But if you've enjoyed this show, if you're able to leave a review on your favourite podcast platform, you know the deal. Make it a 5-star review. The word stupendous might be strong for a needlework podcast, but don't be afraid to use it. And I'll be back next week with another conversation. So here we go. Needle Exchange with Orly Kogan. Enjoy the show. Do you think that your the content of your art changed after motherhood?
Yes. My interest in interpersonal dynamic or sexual dynamics, power struggles, any kind of, I guess, anything related to being single and looking for love, all those concepts became less of a focus, less of an interest, because that wasn't happening in my life actively. So, you know, I did a whole series of sort of bachelor girls and like the lifestyle of being like, you know, single girl about town type of thing. And that certainly that work was very period for me, because that's not what's happening for me now or when I was, you know, had a baby. So yeah, the work, it then moved to fertility. It kind of went with my life, as it does in a similar way. Mm. I dealt with the fertility and then motherhood. And now I'm sort of starting to do pieces about teenagers or having a teenager, which is a very, I mean, it's such an interesting, all the different phases are fascinating and how they, I guess they, it just naturally makes sense for me to incorporate what's going on with me in subtle ways into the work. But you wouldn't necessarily notice it, I think, unless you knew my path.
Mm. Do you think there'll come a point when your work, because I mean, obviously, like you say, you're doing work to do with a teenager now because you've got a teenager. Is there going to come a point when your work's going to overlap with the work you did? Like, say your work reflecting you as a 20-something, and you'll end up possibly doing work that reflects your daughter as a 20-something, or that kind of like mode? Do you think there'll be like this overlapping?
You mean that I'd be channeling what she was going through in through the work?
Maybe, or I'm just wondering, you know, like, for instance, does the work that you're doing as a teenager involve you reflecting on yourself as a teenager, or is it much more connected with your daughter as a teenager and the life that you see at this point?
I think it's more reflective of how I see it myself as a mother, and my dynamic, that female dynamic of mother-daughter relationship. And also how kids are today. I mean, you know, growing up with technology, it's a very different way to grow up. So.
Mm. Are you able to draw any conclusions? Or I suppose that's the problem, isn't it? I'm the same. Like, I just think about like the way the world was when I was a kid and the way the world is now, my kid's a kid, and what the differences are. And I don't know whether I often am just like realizing that I sound like an old man going, oh, I used to be a lot better. Like, I used to be a lot better back when I was a kid.
What do you mean better?
Simpler. Mm. Maybe I just see it that way. Less complicated. I don't know whether that is purely a technological thing, but I think that in the same way as we can tie into seeing everything in the world in an instant, because we can't very accurately curate that content, or certainly we can curate it for ourselves, but it's really hard to curate it for our loved ones. Then you just think there's a lot more barrage.
Yes, I think having everyone having a phone in their back pocket, not only does it give you access to all sorts of things you wouldn't normally be seeing or reading or listening to or anything, it speeds up development or knowledge or. Too much. Like it, you're looking at things that you would never see or never even think about. And it also makes kids and adults more focused on themselves. There's a lot of like, I mean, how many times you take pictures of yourself or other people? Like, we never walked around with cameras growing up. So there's this whole, the way kids are growing up now, there's a real different sense of identity because they're everything is documented all the time. So you're moving through the world looking at hundreds of pictures of yourself since the beginning, since your parents are doing it, and then you get a phone and then you do it. And it's a really big jump between parents that grew up without technology and their children that are growing up with technology. It's such a different way of moving through the world and looking at the world and looking at themselves. So constantly looking at themselves and comparing themselves. And we didn't have that burden.
No, you just get randomly bullied. Well, I just got randomly bullied by, you know, peers at school or whatever, but I wasn't getting bullied by everything else. I could still go home and watch cartoons and really not think about it or whatever. It wasn't.
Yeah, wasn't it didn't the same. Follow you everywhere.
Mm. Do you find that the work that you made helped you process the things you were going through at the time? Was it that kind of reflection, or was it a bit more abstract than that?
Probably when I was single and kind of looking for love and dating, and then when I fell in love and was spending so much time in the studio alone and depicting my fiance, because, you know, I just wanted to be around him, and so he would end up being in the pieces because it would be a way to connect. But before that, I would do, yeah, family, friends. I think when you're alone, I'm naturally a very social person, but I spend most of my time by myself. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times I would put people in my work, not necessarily playing themselves, like, again, playing a character within the storyline of the piece. But it would just be more fun and make sense for me to articulate people I already knew and cared about in the work.
So this is the thing then, if you, like, I'm just looking at some of the pictures from Push Stitchery. So I'm looking at, for instance, Fairy Tale 2006. And there's pictures of you, there's pictures of your friends. But the way you've done them, I guess, is that kind of Botticelli, Rubenesque right. style of thing. Because long story short, they're all naked. Now, it's one thing for you to portray yourself naked. It's another thing for you to portray significant others in your work naked. And I'm just interested in how you managed to get around that, or what the kind of deal was. Because presumably your fiance is like, hi, everybody, like come to your show and be like, yep, that's me. I just wonder how you kind of work it out.
Because I grew up, you know, looking at paintings where everyone was always nude. Like, to me, that's how I grew up. It wouldn't even occur to me to put clothing on figures. Because that would mean that I would date them, and I was interested in fashion, and I was interested in making the art where you could say, oh, that's sort of, you know, that's 1970s style, or that's 80s. Like, once you involve fashion, it becomes a very different thing. If you're doing nude figures, that clears the decks. It's timeless. It's it's original art. It's Adam and Eve. I mean, I feel like it. I was so influenced by, I guess, those old paintings. It wouldn't even occur to me to put clothing on it, on the people. It would be about other things. It wouldn't be about the stories that they were doing. It would be more, I don't know, it would just change it. I mean, it could be interesting. It'd be more about pattern and design and socio-economical. But, I mean, there's just so many things go into putting clothing on people. Then it brings in a whole, many, many different things. If they're nude, that's just like, then you're just back in like the Bible, and you know, that kind of thing. So for me, it was just that was traditional drawing.
It's funny, isn't it? Because it does, it sort of elevates the people out of humanity, because we don't do that. We don't just meander around naked anymore with like within a flowery garden and stuff. So you're just pretty much instantly making gods out of people.
Yeah, I was thinking that of them, of those images, more as like otherworldly, really. Not maybe some of the concepts would be contemporary, but the way it was depicted was more whimsical and not, you know, fairy tale, like more living on another plane of some kind. More magical.
It's almost like a dreamlike nature to it all.
Yes, and where there weren't, the pieces, even the pieces now, I'm starting to put some clothes on the pieces where I'm doing ones that have clothes that have to do with, you know, social dynamic or that kind of thing, but it really changes it. It brings it back down to earth. It doesn't keep it on that sort of celestial fear. As soon as the clothes come on, it becomes a very different thing.
Because then you've also talked about feminine archetypes quite a lot. Pinup girls, Lolitas, Madonnas, those kind of things. And I suppose you're always, like you say, you're always in this celestial thing, aren't you? You're always looking at like overarching stereotypes that could quite easily be like 5,000 years old, those kind of stories. Yeah.
Yes. And I also, I don't know if you notice, I always have pubic hair on my figures. And that's sort of a campaign against the contemporary idea of needing to be hairless, because I associate like being hairless is more like being childlike. You know, children don't have body hair, but then when you get older, it's sort of a rite of passage. I mean, you know, you're full-on adult, you have body hair. And like the Samson story, that gives you strength. That's part of being an adult. And I guess, you know, removing it makes you more childlike or more weaker or something, an unobtainable, unnatural thing. And also now is connected to porn. So I've always made it my mission to, whenever I'm depicting a nude female, to make sure she has underarm hair and pubic hair and not not be some idealized childlike figure when it comes to that piece of symbolism.
But I think the other thing that I note from your work as well is it's, you know, it's like you're sticking up for women, but you're not going, we're better. You're very much, it feels to me like you're very much just going, look, we're all equals. Like all of your work is just fairly even Stevens.
That's right. I don't have an axe to grind against anybody really. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's, yeah, it's just interesting that, isn't it? Because I think sometimes people can look at work, particularly, and as well, I think that's the thing. Sometimes people look at work and because it's got nudity in it, it's almost like it feels like you're being political from the get-go, whereas you're just kind of being whimsical with it.
Right. I'm coming from a background with the news. The background is more like traditional, I guess. You know, if I walk around the old museums, that's what I'm drawn to, the angels and the saints and they're all nude or have little cloaks or some kind of piece of fabric floating around maybe. But if I put that on the figures, then it would hold it down too much in history. So I did away with a cloak or a handkerchief or something. But yeah, it's really just more even the playing field.
And do you think that's why then maybe you're conscious of like your body of work and your legacy? Because in some ways the work that you're making has this like timelessness, like you kind of would like it to still be reasonable in like 500 years or something.
That would be fabulous if it was still around in 500 years.
I mean, there's a chance because it's textiles. Do you know what I mean? Doesn't rely on electricity. I always think we've always got an advantage here over the people that are making like NFTs or whatever, because it's like in a post-apocalyptic era, there might still be textiles.
Well, you have to take care with the sunlight and with moths or mold. I mean, there's a lot to taking care of the textiles too.
Hmm. Can you just talk through your process a little bit, like in terms of like the making of the pieces and stuff? Because you do, I mean, you've come from a painting background. You do still use those elements within your work, right?
Yes, I do a lot of drawing and drawing from pictures I take. I use a lot of resource material like coloring books and art history books. I'm even doing a lot of sort of art about art a little bit. I love dropping in like a drawing from Egon Schiele or something from art history or an artist that I like. Even some storybooks, little pieces of Cat in Hat or something. I take from all different resources and sort of incorporate it here and there. I've got a lot of picture books from my childhood and from my daughters that I like using as reference material, along with just, you know, what I'm seeing out there in the world.
Mm. And you sort of spring off, don't you, in different directions? Like I've seen you do pieces that have got like kind of sculptural elements and those kind of things. And then, but you're still the vintage fabric figurative pieces are still like the core thrust of your river.
Yeah, I've got so much of that. My mother had been collecting for so many years. I've got bins and bins of tablecloths and bed covers. And sometimes I feel like I want to cut out the bits and pieces, but then I feel precious about it, and I don't want to do too much cutting up. And I kind of go back and forth now, where I'm thinking about using a combination of not only the vintage but the printed, and then putting it together. And I don't, because I'm not a machine person, I don't know how to use a sewing machine. So everything is done by hand. But I do have these ideas that I want to splice together some of the vintage materials I'm using along with contemporary piece, you know, textiles and fabrics as a jumping point to the thread drawings on top. But I'm I'm always sort of searching a friend who can just sewing machine these pieces that I have pinned together. And it always seems kind of a burden, like to say, do you know how to use a sewing machine? Can you sew like these five pieces together for me so I can like work on that? So I guess one day I'll have to buckle down and learn how to use one.
I mean, of all the technologies out there, the good thing about a sewing machine is it's relatively uncomplicated. So you have got a good chance. But I can't help thinking that with you, it would have to be, it wouldn't just be like, I don't know, I feel like it couldn't just be like straight lines. You couldn't just be doing a bit of quilting and piecework. You know, yours would end up being a bit more flourishy, or it would end up being a bit more left field somehow.
I don't know. I just know that I work best one-on-one. So I couldn't learn from like a computer or someone just sort of talking me through it. I'd have to have like sit down and have like...
I think you might need to get one of those ones with the table or with the handle as well. That feels like the Orly Kogan style of sewing machine. As analog as it's possible.
Yes.
Are you going in a particular direction at the moment? Are you feeling the pull of particular works or anything?
I've been incorporating some ceramics in my work, which has been a lot of fun and completely different, where I'm doing some like clay work and then putting holes in it and then doing weaving attached to it and more like sculptural things. And then a bit of pieces of ceramics incorporated in 2D works where I'm doing a bit more abstractions along with the figurative pieces, but kind of combining things, doing more experimentation with mixture of mediums.
Is it like you're flirting with these mediums just to see whether the creative juices kind of pick up and give you a reason to run with it?
Yeah, I think so.
I like it. Right. When I started, when we start with the conversation, or I hopefully sent you a few very standard questions I was going to ask you that hopefully you've been able to prepare for.
Yeah, I've been trying.
Okay. So for some reason, it's quite funny how like the people I talk to, like we can talk about like the creative journey and finding your muse and all this like philosophical stuff that's quite straightforward. And then I'll go, so what is your favorite band? And they'll be like, oh, sweet Jesus, I can't work that one out or whatever. But let's try this. Orly Kogan, who's your favorite band?
So any of the favorites question, I don't have a favorite.
Okay.
But I would say basically 60s, 70s, 80s, classic rock is what I listen to when I'm listening to music, like, you know, Beatles, Stevie Nicks, Eagles, Heart, Debbie Harry, you know, like classic rock and roll from the 70s.
Do you listen to music while you're working?
Usually listen to NPR. It's like a news radio. NPR? What does it stand for?
National Public Radio. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, because that really informs me with politics and sort of keeps me very current. Like, you know, it's almost like instead of reading the newspaper, I'll listen to NPR while I work. And I feel like I'm out there and knowing what's going on in the world politically. And, you know, listen to some podcasts like Katie Hessel. You know her, right?
No.
No, she's British. She does a podcast.
Oh, she's the other British podcaster. That one.
Who's British? She does a podcast called Great American... Oh, I'm sorry, not Great American. Great Women Artists. Have you heard of her?
No.
Okay, well,
but I'm going to look it up. Women
Artists. And The Moth is another podcast I listen to, which is people telling personal stories. You know that one?
Yeah. We met. My wife got The Moth book, I think, which was a good collection of short stories.
Oh, okay.
They kind of curated a book, I think, off of the back of the show. Because that was, for a long time, wasn't it just like that was like an actual event where people would go and tell the short stories, and then it kind of evolved into a podcast? Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. It still is. I think they still have a live place where they go and do that. Yeah.
Mm. So that would those count as your favorite podcast? Because I slide that one in now. I realize I started out with like, you know, favorite bands, favorite albums and that sort of thing. But podcasts do come along.
Because it's something people listen to while they're working.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm. And I go through phases where I listen to you know, certain bands for a while, or even certain songs that I can't get out of my head and I'll just play on loop or something.
So what was the last good song that really got stuck in your head? Can you remember?
I love the Double Fantasy album with John Lennon and Yoko Ono, but the John Lennon songs in particular. I'm just sitting here watching the wheels go round and round. Do you know that album?
That's a song. I'm going to have to listen to that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a song I can listen to over and over again. Or a lot of the songs on that album of his, I really like.
Yeah, I've not really listened to much like post-Beatles John Lennon, truth be told. I think it's almost like I'd kind of written it off in my head just because it was a bit. But then, yeah, that was just him meandering off. I've listened to plenty of like Wings. So obviously, maybe I prefer Paul to John. I don't know. But did you...
Well, I remember the John Lennon, that last album he did called Double Fantasy. I remember as a kid, my mom let me stay up late one night and listen to a live interview on the radio that he did about that album. And I don't know if this is accurate timeline, but it felt like the next day after he recorded that interview, he got shot. And it was right. So big to me as a Beatles fan, as a John Lennon fan, a New Yorker, that happened. And that it was such a special thing that my mom let me listen to that interview live on a school night. And it was just, I mean, I have the album, I have the actual record
right.
that you play on the turntable. So that probably holds a special place because of that like little piece of history from my childhood. Yeah.
Did you listen to the new Beatles single?
I might have heard it once.
Okay. It's an interesting experiment, I suppose. It's kind of weird because in some ways you feel like they're done and then they kind of dredged this last song up and kind of bolted it together, and it was kind of like the story of it was arguably more interesting than the song of it, I think.
Huh. That's like what I was saying before, like somebody tearing up your sketchbook or putting up a bunch of unfinished pieces in a museum that weren't meant to be seen yet.
Yeah, yeah, that's it, isn't it? Because, yeah, even I think because they tried to make it about 20 years ago and then it all kind of fell apart. And then they used a bit of AI and managed to get the sound to come out better from the original track and stuff. But, yeah, still... Yeah, like you say, John Lennon could be going, yeah, no, I really wouldn't. I know you think I wanted that song out, but really, I was having a bad day on that one. That's fair.
But in that case, wouldn't Yoko have, didn't she have say? She must have had say.
I guess she must have nodded it through. Yeah, something like that, yeah. Maybe. Yeah. Do you have a favorite book, or what was the last good book you read?
So... My daughter advised me to go light on this, but
okay.
I suffer from dyslexia back since I was a little kid when nobody even knew what the heck that was. I just felt like a dummy who struggled in school with math and reading. And even though they did figure it out and gave it a name back then, it was something that was not really understood. And anyway, and now even as an adult, I rarely read for pleasure. I mean, I do, but it's more like sound bites and,
right.
And it's something that, you know, it's a drag actually. I feel like in my life, if I think of just trajectory, it was a struggle when I was real little, and then I kind of plateaued, and I got better at interpreting words and understanding and being able to read more fluidly. And then now, at this stage of life, it seems to have fallen back a bit. I don't know what's going on with them, but I guess it's just, I don't know, a circle of life or, you know, and so I'm struggling more with interpretation, with patience, whatever it is that how the brain works, with looking at words. And so even though I read regularly, I don't read like books. I'll read like articles or some like, you know, I'll listen to books. Certainly I'll listen to them, which is so nice now that as a kid, you know, you didn't really have that access to listen so much. But it doesn't, I mean, listening is wonderful for storytelling, but it doesn't really help your skills. So I can't really say, I mean, you know, I read books like on topics I want to improve on, like, you know, I'll read like books about health or books about, you know, parenting or books about healthy eating or right. I don't know, emotional improvement, like some kind of like books on improvement and that kind of things.
If you've got, so yeah, because I can understand it, because it's a bit like, I don't know, if you had to go swimming and some people swim for fun, but the only swimming you can do is the doggy paddle. So therefore it takes you twice as long to do the same amount of swimming as anybody else does. I can understand that that would just, like you say, be a real drag. It's not that much fun because I guess your brain does have to just work harder.
Yeah, it's like more sure. Like I love to be read too. Right. That I love, and I understand it better than if I were to read it to myself. I might have to read it to myself twice to like get the words and then get the concept, and it's just more cumbersome.
Can I ask a dumb question?
There are no dumb questions.
Thanks very much. So, like with the dyslexia, if you were reading a fiction book and it was something that was describing a scene, would it therefore take you longer to build that scene in your head because you've got to go through that bit of extra aggro to process it?
I don't know. The processing part is, for at least for me, I think it's different for everyone, but how their brain works and how they interpret it. But like for me, it's just like getting the job of the technicality of deciphering the words. So there's that. And then the words that are put together that build the story conceptually. So I get through the words and then I might need to read it again to get the idea. But it depends on the piece, depends how long it is. Like I did read this book, that my daughter read first and loved. She's a good reader, which thank goodness. it was called, I think it's Daisy and the Six. Do you know that one? It's become quite popular.
I feel like Daisy Jones. I've heard it. Yeah.
Daisy Jones.
It's become a TV show, isn't it?
It has. Yeah. Mm. But the book is written in a very interesting linear way, which I breezed through and loved, almost more like a play. Right. So it's each character just saying their line in like the present tense. And the way it was broken up was really fluid for me versus like the way most books are written. This one was just, more like a play, like each character's name and then what they said to each other.
Yeah, and that's really interesting, isn't it? Because that's just stripping away. It's like taking the clothes off the story and just stripping away so you've just got the tale. I feel like there could be an analogy there.
You're good at that. That's great.
But also, right. it makes me interested as well, because I feel like maybe that's part of the pleasure that you get from your own storytelling through your work as well, is that you're using a naturally slow medium. So it all just comes at a bit more of a kind of orally natural pace.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, for me, art was my savior in school. Like it was a very natural place to go to be an artist, because I did struggle so much with the academics and really felt quite self-conscious about not being that great at them, having to work extra hard at them. But what I didn't have to work so extra hard is art making. And so I became sort of the artist of the class. So when you're in a small class, every kid kind of gets their little identity thing, you know, the clown, the artist, the math whiz, whatever it is, the sports guy. And so, that's how I built up my identity and my, and sort of my self, self-worth and worthiness as a child. Like, okay, I'm terrible at math and reading, but look what I can draw, everybody. And that gave me respect.
Yeah.
And then I just went with that. My parents saw that and just, you know, we're like supporting that. Yeah.
Do you ever read graphic novels? Is that something that's in your wheelhouse?
I that was the opening to my daughter being interested in reading, actually. But I haven't. I know when we were kids, they were like comic books, and it was always, it was like smushed together. Everything was really smushed together, the writing. And yeah, I never went that way.
I've got a recommendation for her and for you if you're interested, which is called Supergirl, Woman of Tomorrow. And it's written by a guy called Tom King. And it's just fantastic. I read it to Flora. I think I've said about it in the podcast before, but I read it to Flora a little while ago, because what's great is obviously I've read comics since I was about 8, and that's like quite a while ago, you know, so like late 1980s comics in the UK, not a brilliant choice. And obviously now this is a completely different ball game, but I'm able to introduce Flora to the kind of comics that would have blown my mind if I'd have read them at the right age. And Supergirl's fantastic. It's like such a good story. It makes you realize she's so much better than Superman. Everyone always just goes, oh, she's just like Superman's cousin. But honestly, it's fantastic. So if you can get that out of the library or the graphic novel or whatever, you'll love it. So good.
Oh, thank you.
Pro tip.
The words are all smushed together and teeny tiny.
Sometimes, but the visuals will get you through it as well. You could read it together, maybe. I had to explain to my 5-year-old the concept of genocide off of the back of it, but it's not overt genocide. It's just part of the storytelling, and now she's more learned than her classmates. What was the last good film you saw in that case?
The last good film? I thought the question was...
Or what's your favourite film? Well, it's, yeah, what's your favourite film? But you said earlier you were like, I don't really have any favourites, so what's your favourite film then?
So I don't have favorites, that's true, but the ones I could think of on the top of my head that give me most joy are, again, back to my childhood, it was The Sound of Music and Fiddler on the Roof, Oklahoma, ones I could like get up and sing along with, and still The Sound of Music gives me a lot of pleasure. And contemporary films... I feel like I haven't seen that many recently that I thought were something to advise. There is something for adults only that I saw on, I don't know, one of the platforms. It wasn't a movie theater movie that I can recommend that I thought was extraordinary. And I wrote down the name of it because it's a tricky name. So it's called Good Luck to You, Leo Grande.
Oh, yeah, that's to do with male escort, right?
Yes. So it's an older woman, and it's just like 3 people in the whole movie, mainly 2 people. And it's really, it's so well done. It's about sexuality and sensuality and relationships and body identity and aging, and
Emma Thompson.
Yes. Yeah, I mean definitely an adult movie, but really extraordinarily done.
I do feel like you're the kind of person that it would be quite tricky to go down Blockbusters and get a video out for Orly. You'd be like, oh, this could be tricky. She's not an easy one to peg down.
That's true. I don't like superhero movies and stuff like that. Although I did see Barbie. I did. And that's,
how do you feel about Barbie?
Well, I felt like they did a good job to advertise and put forth feminism to the masses. I think you needed to package it that way in order to get the messages to the masses, which worked well. I mean, you know, there was a time where that term was like something girls didn't want to be because they had mixed up associations with it, like not liking men or not being feminine or being, or whatever it was, being angry. And it's come back now where it's okay and you can be feminine and you can like guys and it's strength and presence. And Barbie was such a mixed, she's a mix anyway, like they said in the movie, you know, where she was sort of anti-feminist because she's looks like she's all, you know, made of, well, she is made of plastic, but you know, like the women want to emulate that body type, which is unnatural and the male gaze and all that business. But they kind of turned that on its head a bit and brought it into a feministic way of looking at it, which is a clever way to turn that around a bit. And the way they did it in that movie, it was in order to sell it to, like, you know, middle America, where they wouldn't, because they wouldn't go see like a movie about feminism if you put it out there out front, blatant. But if you package it in Barbie and then kind of slide that in, I think it was effective for that particular kind of audience.
Yeah. Yeah. I enjoyed it. I think I cried at the end. Mary had slightly fallen asleep at the end, so she missed the really nice emotional bit where it all really ties up in like the last 5 minutes. I think she nodded off by then.
I could have used a lot of editing, but I feel that about most movies. I come out of almost every movie thinking, yeah, they could have edited that one down.
Yeah, no, I like that. Right, so the last question then.
Yeah.
What is the one interesting fact that nobody really knows about Orly Kogan?
This was a tricky one because if it's something no one knows, it's probably there's a reason for that. Right?
Wait. Maybe, yeah.
People answer that they have to. They do they actually reveal something?
Well, the thing is, you don't need to reveal anything that you know you don't want to reveal. But it will turn out that you know you're excellent at roller skating or something that not all people know. You probably are, aren't you?
Let's see. Here's one. I think my husband Robert and my daughter Viva know this, but I don't think anyone else knows. So now you'll know.
All right.
So I say. For what it's worth, I save a lot of voicemail messages from my parents in preparation for when they're no longer here, so I can listen to their voice again. Because I, as an only child, in particular, those two people, they're the only other people in the world that know my childhood, know me throughout my life. Like I can't look to a sibling and say and talk about my past. And so when you're in that way, when you don't have siblings or cousins or aunts and uncles, and you know, people that were really there day by day, once your parents are gone, there's no one else to connect you to in that kind of way. So I feel like I'm almost like prepared to miss them so badly that I know once they're gone, I'll never hear their voice ever again. So I save all their voice messages in preparation to be able to listen to them leaving me a sweet message when they're no longer here.
I mean, that is really nice because you do see those, and maybe it's just on the telly, I don't know, but people who are just listening to voicemail messages because that person died and they forgot to do that. So I like your planning there. I mean, I'm essentially an only child because I was like an only child for like 16 years.
Oh, wow.
But it's like, it's interesting that I've got like half siblings. So in many ways, I am still an only child because I don't really see them very often. But it's interesting what you just said there. Like, I suppose they're the people that knew you when you were little and can give you perspective on how much you've changed. Is that what you're getting at?
Well, that I have a bit because I do have some, you know, my mom has one sister and then we have some cousins. My mom has some cousins here and there. But I guess so. I mean, there is some family around for that kind of thing. Like, oh, when you were little, you used to say "wado" instead of water or whatever little antidotes. But I guess, like when you have a sibling that's growing up in the home, you can talk together about your parents and about the way certain techniques were, or the way you were raised, or you sort of saw stories, where it's all your own memory when you're just a singleton in the home, and the history, your history, you just have to remember as it is. There's no one to check in on, you know,
no one to triangulate your position.
Yeah,
Yeah, that's interesting because my wife's one of four and she's really close with her family and she talks. Usually, if my wife phones me on the way home from work, I know it's because her mum and her sister are out. That's, you know, that's kind of how close they are or whatever. But yeah, it's interesting that because I don't find that I reflect a lot on my childhood. I've mostly just put it behind me now because I can't say it was the most exciting childhood, whatever. But I do think the older you get, the more I want to talk with my family about like their history and, you know, gauge a bit of a sense of, I don't know, maybe time and space or perspective or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess I feel like I would, like when my parents do pass away, because like you said, your wife would have called her mom or her sister before you. Like they're the two people I call most when I'm excited to tell some good news, or if I really need a piece of advice where I feel like I won't be judged later for like telling that or having that question or whatever it is. Like with some friends, you know, you might not share everything because then you feel like when you complain about somebody, then they'll look at that person in a different way after that issue had long gone. So you don't bother telling them because fear of judgment or whatever it is. So it's such a pure relationship with my parents that I feel like I will really be missing that connection when those two people go.
Do you do a good job of like, so we bought this book called like A Mother's Journal, and what it is it's kind of like just a bunch of questions that you are meant to ask your parents because they're not the questions you think to ask them. So maybe about like the fashions at the time when they were young, or you know, when do they remember their first set of driving lessons, like all these really obscure kind of questions that are really useful for building this like full history of them. It sounds to me like your relationship with your parents is fairly solid. I wonder whether you've already had those kind of chats.
Those questions, I guess, would be more interesting to a grandchild that doesn't know or have the focus or interest at the time to investigate those questions with my parents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think, but for me, that stuff, like the questions you just said to me are like frivolous and don't matter anyway. Like I know the big stuff that's important, I think. Mm. And it's less about their stuff, honestly. And it's more about my dynamic with them. Okay. It's more about my relationship with them and like what they would say or how they would react in relation to something I brought up in my life. That I will feel missing rather than just sort of about their life. It's more a relationship to my dynamic with them that will no longer be there. And my God, then who will be there for that? And I guess I'll have to make some deeper friendships.
You're probably going to have to like program in. You probably need to forward think outcomes, get your parents to send you voicemail notes responding to those situations ahead of time, and then you can like boop section B1. Orly has let me down today.
The funny thing is that you know it all anyway. When you know people so well, you know what they're gonna say and how they think and everything. It's not even that specifically. It's just, I don't know. It's just you just ask. Yeah, it's just like, I don't know, it's almost like feeling nostalgia for something that's still here. Like you're a piece of me mourning something and preparing to mourn something that's still happening. Like,
yeah, you're giving yourself a safety net. You're giving yourself, you know, you've got this buffer because when they're gone, you'll still be able to hear them. You're just doing it in advance, whereas most people do that in retrospect.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, something like that.
That's good. I like it. I like it a lot. You made me feel about I should go and talk to my mum now for a minute. But anyway.
Yeah, or record her and then you can get it when you want.
That's true. Hey, Orly, thanks for having a needle exchange with me.
Thank you. You're so easy to talk to. Conversation flows very easily.
It's very kind.
And very kind. I appreciate everything you're doing. I'll tell you, you are such a... You're so... No, I'm losing the words, but I admire you so much for everything you've built and everything you're sharing with everyone. And it's just, you're doing a fantastic job. And it's such a unique vision and presence to do all the things you've been doing and highlighting all these people working with these materials. It's monumental.
Oh,
be proud of yourself.
Feeling a bit emotional. Thanks, Molly.
Fantastic.
Thanks for joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange, that's needle.exchange, with any thoughts, comments or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needle exchange. See you next time.